Tehran and Beijing say they will enhance bilateral relations regardless of international developments. Iranian president is paying a state visit to China. The World Health Organization has described the recent devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria as the worst natural disaster in a century. An Indian tax officer has raided BBC offices after the state British broadcaster airs a documentary critical of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Mirzajafi. Good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in China on a three-day state visit. Meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Raisi said that Tehran is determined to boost cooperation with Beijing.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
Now, Raisi said that both governments have shown willingness to enhance bilateral cooperation despite opposition from their adversaries. The president added that Tehran and Beijing maintain their friendship in hard times and can strengthen their bonds further. He called for bigger steps to implement the 25-year cooperation agreement, saying that this will contribute to peace and stability in the region and beyond. President Xi Jinping, for his part, said that Beijing would develop friendly cooperation with Iran, no matter how international and regional situations change.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Now, she also hailed growing solidarity and cooperation with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other and worked together in the face of the current complex global challenges. He also extended China's support for Iran in safeguarding its national sovereignty and independence, as well as resisting hegemony and unilateralism. She said that Beijing is opposed to any foreign interference in Iran's internal affairs or undermining its security and stability. The two sides have signed a number of cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, and tourism, among others. President Raisi also held talks with Chinese Prime Minister and top lawmaker. He will later meet with Chinese businessmen and Iranian expatriates. All right, now from Oslo, let's bring in Glenn Deason. He's a professor of political science with the University of Southeastern Norway to ask his opinion about growing Iran-China relations.
Well, Iran's role in the region, that's the Eurasian region, is growing quite rapidly. And the reason is a lot of the key players from Russia to China, but obviously China, the most important economic actor, a key strategy for them is Eurasian integration. So seeking economic connectivity between the major players on the Eurasian continent, which is why most now consider Iran to be a strategic partner. So this connectivity between China and Iran is therefore seen as a counterweight to U.S. efforts of establishing hegemony.
Mm-hmm. And Glenn, as you know, President Biden said a while ago, in the State of Union address, I believe that the U.S. is not for conflict, it's for actually cooperation, but this is not actually happening on the ground when you see. So would such bonds and relationships, something that Iran, China, they're doing, other countries are also, Russia, Turkey, and others, BRICS countries and others, they are getting closer together, and that's mostly thanks to what's happening in the world and mostly impacted by what the U.S. has been doing to all these countries. So how would this affect the economic equations around the globe and economy in future?
Well, the game of empire hasn't really changed much through history. It's still very much divide and conquer, which is how America has also always established itself as the central actor. So a key strategy for the United States and before it Great Britain has always been to keep a division between the main actors. So in Europe, keep the Germans and the Russians apart. But now we see with Eurasian integration, they're pursuing a similar approach. So they want Russia and China to be apart. They want to split Iran from China, Iran from Russia, Turkey from Iran, India from Iran, Turkey from Russia, Russia from China. So you know, all of these relationships which are established independent of the United States is considered a problem. And a key reason now is we see that a lot of these countries, they're establishing cooperation in the sphere of a technology, the integrating industries, the developing new transportation corridors, the developing new development banks, the trading in their local currencies. They're developing new payment system to circumvent SWIFT. So effectively, the United States can dominate because of its economic instruments of power. Now, what China and other actors are doing with Eurasian integration entails immunizing themselves from this, so removing a lot of this leverage which the United States has, which is why the U.S. will counter it as well, because their interest is to have the U.S. at the center of the international economic system.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Glenn Deason, Professor of Political Science with the University of Southeastern Norway, who joined me from Oslo. Now, I also talked to John Ross, who's a senior fellow at the Chang'an Institute for Financial Studies, and he said that Iran and China have a strong motivation to get closer.
Iran is a country with a great long history. It's a very important country, and it wants to pursue not aggression against anybody else. It's not interested in that, but it's interested in pursuing the path of its own development. And the United States wants to instead impose a prevention of this. And naturally, therefore, it has created a situation in which Iran looks to other countries which are willing to respect that. These are include China, but they include many other countries. For example, Brazil, for example, a newly elected president, Lula, has said quite clearly, as the way he put it was, we are at war with poverty. We're not at war with Russia. And I think he meant by that we're not at war with Iran and we're not at war with China either. Mm-hmm. So this is just a natural development of the situation. You have two developments taking place in the world. One is the majority of countries want to pursue their own path of independence, economic development, and getting on with their own affairs. And the United States is attempting instead to impose a situation where other countries act against their own interests in the interest of the United States. Iran hasn't gone along with that. China hasn't gone along with it. So it's mm-hmm. natural that Iran and China should form better relations, and this is a very, they've got mutually beneficial relations. Iran is one of the most important energy suppliers in the world. China is the most important manufacturing center in the world, so they've got a lot of in common to get on with.
Now, the World Health Organization has described the recent devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria as the worst natural disaster in a century.
We are witnessing the worst natural disaster in the WHO European region for a century, and we are still learning about its magnitude. Its true cost is not known yet. Recovering and healing will take time and a phenomenal effort.
In a virtual press conference from London, WHO Director for Europe said that the UN Health Agency has initiated its largest ever deployment of emergency medical teams to help some 26 million people in need of humanitarian aid. Nearly 39,000 people have been killed after the 7.8 magnitude quake and a powerful aftershock jolted Turkey and Syria last week. Some 3,500 fatalities have been confirmed in Syria, the country already wrecked by years of militancy and sanctions. Meantime, the UN called for international funding to help the people of quake-ravaged Syria.
Good morning. Today, I'm announcing that the United Nations is launching a $397 million humanitarian appeal for the people of earthquake-ravaged Syria.
The UN chief says the funds would bring life-saving relief, including shelter, healthcare, and food for nearly 5 million Syrians over a period of 3 months. He added that the world body is the final stage of a similar appeal for Turkey. Activists and emergency teams have slammed the UN for its slow response to quake-hit areas in northern Syria. The UN has announced the opening of two border crossings from Turkey to ease the flow of aid into northern Syria. Earlier, the UN aid convoy arrived in the terrorist-held Syrian areas through newly opened Bab al-Hawa crossing. People in Syria have been left isolated as they are grappling with the aftermath of a devastating earthquake in the northern part of that country. Years of foreign-backed militancy and Western sanctions are hampering aid efforts to the quake-hit region. The UN international agencies already lamented the failure of sending desperately needed aid to the Arab country, saying that people there feel abandoned. Now, while search and rescue efforts go on in Syria, terrorists in control of the quaked areas have been complicating the aid deliveries. The terrorists say that they won't allow the government to take advantage of the situation and to show it's helping the people there.
Years of war in Syria has destabilized the region, which is still suffering from an ongoing humanitarian emergency. Millions are displaced within Syria or have fled to Turkey, which is contending with high inflation and a deepening economic crisis. The earthquake unleashed widespread damage and destruction in some of the most at-risk areas in the region. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck near Nurdaghi in southern Turkey around 4:17 a.m. local time on February 6th. A magnitude 7.5 earthquake followed around later that afternoon around 1 p.m. local time, along with scores of powerful aftershocks. Thousands are injured and thousands more remain trapped in the rubble, and the chance of finding survivors gets narrower and narrower. Search and recovery operations continue with assistance from teams around the world. But freezing weather is hampering rescue efforts and making it even more difficult to access possible survivors. This catastrophe hit an already fragile region, which has been marred by decades of war in Syria and economic, humanitarian, and public health crises. Turkey is facing a profound economic crisis, with a collapsing currency and extraordinary inflation that hit around 80% last year, the highest in about 25 years. The quake-hit part of Turkey also hosts a large population of Syrian refugees. The economic crisis in Turkey has helped fuel a backlash against the approximately 3.6 million Syrian refugees in the country, who are already facing poverty, discrimination, an increase in violent attacks, and the risk of deportation. More than 2 million people in northwestern Syria are also at risk of a deadly cholera outbreak. The outbreak began in northeastern Syria, attributed to contaminated water from the Euphrates River, which people were relying on in part because of the water infrastructure destroyed by years of fighting. About 47% of people in Syria rely on unsafe drinking water, a potentially even bigger risk after the massive infrastructure damage by the earthquake. In northwest Syria, in particular, this outbreak was straining an already stretched and under-resourced health system, which will now also need to find ways to treat those injured in the earthquake. The devastation extends beyond northwest Syria, as the country as a whole has been overwhelmed by years of war and destruction. International sanctions against Syria are also deepening the economic crisis Syrians face. The country faces record and widespread poverty and food shortages. About 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nearly 75% struggle to meet their most basic needs. And across the region, the crisis is still acute, as agencies and officials rush to find survivors in the rubbles and temperatures drop. The earthquake compounds catastrophe upon catastrophe in Syria and Turkey. It is likely to exacerbate those that already exist while creating new, unpredictable ones.
Indian tax officers have raided the BBC's offices in capital New Delhi and Mumbai after the British broadcaster aired a documentary critical of Prime Minister Modi. Police sealed off the BBC's New Delhi office after the raid. A spokesman for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party accuses the network of engaging in anti-India propaganda. The spokesman said the BBC should not spew venom while operating in the country. The broadcaster said it was fully cooperating with the authorities. Last month, BBC aired a two-part documentary alleging that Modi pushed the police to turn a blind eye to the massacre of hundreds of Muslims in Gujarat in 2002. Modi was the state's chief minister at the time. The New Delhi correspondent Munawwar Zaman joined us and told us why the right-wing Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is cracking down on opposing voices and dissent.
The story is that it's not a new story. Actually, there is a crackdown on any voices of dissent in the country. It's been more than 8-9 years now. They are coming really hard on agencies that are critical of the government. Or there are any voices of dissent going on anywhere, whether it be universities, colleges, or public places. I mean, anyone speaking against the government is considered, they're charged with draconian laws and they're locked behind the bars. For example, there are many activists and there are many educationists who have spoken against the government in the past. It's not just the BBC that has faced this trouble this time. It's the media. First of all, I must tell you, now it's turned from media. Now, 3 or 4 years, been a very, very tough for media organizations and, in fact, the freelance journalists who work in this country. So anyone, any voices that are critical of the government, they are charged with either sedition or any other laws that are not new laws. They're the colonial era laws. Mm-hmm. Even the students who talk critical of the government, they are being accused and labeled as anti-national. Now this BBC documentary has again made a lot of controversy across the country, where many activists believe that the movie, it's a censorship. So governments must not do the censorship. There should be a free speech of speech of expression. Freedom of expression should be there. It should be maintained. Even the Supreme Court of the country has turned down a plea.
Several Western countries have voiced strong opposition to the Israeli plan to build more settlements in the occupied West Bank. Foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the United States say that they are deeply troubled by Israel's decision. They see that such unilateral actions would only exacerbate tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, those comments were made just days after the Tel Aviv regime authorized 9 settlement outposts, pledging to construct new settler units in the West Bank. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, during his recent visit to Palestine, called for an end to the Israeli settlement expansion. There are currently around 700,000 settlers living in the occupied territories, and all those Israeli settlements are illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions. Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a teenage boy killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Mahmoud Majid succumbed to injuries he sustained in an Israeli raid on the Al-Farah refugee camp near Nablus. And that happened a day after a 22-year-old Palestinian was killed by the troopers in the same city. The regime has been conducting raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The crackdown has left nearly 50 Palestinians dead since the turn of the year. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
According to the U.S. media, the level of suicide among American youth is devastating. The suicide rate in the United States has increased by about 30% from 2000 to 2018, and this is the highest suicide rate among the rich countries of the world. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The CNN cable news network has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has released data showing an increase in suicide rate in the United States. CDC data showed on Friday, 10th of February, that after a two-year decline in the number of suicides, those deaths went back up in 2021. The data showed that 48,183 people in the U.S. committed suicide in 2021, indicating a year-on-year rise compared to 45,979 deaths in 2020 and 47,511 deaths in 2019. CDC reported that the record high for suicides in a single year came in 2018, when 48,344 Americans took their own lives. The report noted that there was a disparity between the different races and age groups in the United States, and the number of suicides among the youth and black Americans was significantly higher than others. The CDC specifically pointed out that the number of young black Americans who have committed suicide over the most recent three-year period was alarming. The report stated suicide rates among persons aged 10 to 24 years increased significantly during 2018 to 2021, particularly among black persons, from 8.2 to 11.2, a 36.6% increase. The report noted that particular concern with younger black Americans is mirrored among the 25 to 44-year-old age group of different ethnic groups. Hispanics also saw a 19.4% jump, while suicides for non-Hispanic multiracial Americans in that age range rose by 20.6% over the same time period. Julie Goldstein Grummet, Vice President and Director of the Zero Suicide Institute at the Education Development Center, told Yahoo News, "It's much more helpful to understand data at this segmented level because it really helps us to design the right research and the right interventions for the future." She called the figures disheartening, adding, "It's challenging to realize that in some populations suicide is just growing so exponentially. In the meantime, suicide is four times higher in men compared to women. Experts attribute this to the fact that men are more likely to use lethal means and have more difficulty in seeking mental help." The Center for Disease Control, the CDC data, fails to provide a breakdown of the deceased by their social status and level of income. In the United States, suicides have been cited as a leading cause of death. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal analysis found suicide rates increased and disparities widened in 2021, returning to pre-pandemic rates after 2 years of decline. Notably, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's analysis, found the rate of suicide among American Indian and Alaska Native people increased 26% from 2018. Followed by black and Hispanic people, who saw 19.2% and 6.8% increases respectively. CDC researchers said the data raises concerns over access to care and pandemic struggles. The lead author of the report, Deborah M. Stone, told USA Today, "We know that certain groups have been already disadvantaged and have had inequities in suicide risk during COVID-19. These increases are very concerning and point to the need for really some dedicated prevention efforts targeting those racial and ethnic minority groups using culturally relevant programs." The CDC analysis released recently compared rates from 2018 to 2021. In 2021, 48,183 people died by suicide. According to the report, that year the overall age-adjusted suicide rate rose to 14.1 deaths for every 100,000 of the population, returning to the peak seen in 2018 of 14.2 deaths per 100,000 population. In 2020, the rate was 13.5 deaths per 100,000 population. American Indian and Alaska Native people had the highest age-adjusted suicide rates at 28.1 per 100,000 of the population, up from 22.3 in 2018. Suicide rates among black people increased from 7.3 to 8.7 per 100,000 of the population. Among Hispanic people, the suicide rate increased from 7.4 to 7.9 per 100,000. Black children and youth aged between 10 and 24 saw the highest increase, 36.6% of all age groups and racial groups measured. American Indian and Alaska Native people aged between 25 and 44 saw a 33.7% increase. Asian people saw a 1.5% relative increase, which the report noted was not statistically significant. White people were the only group that saw an overall decline of almost 4% compared to 2018. The suicide rate was 17.4 deaths per 100,000 in 2021. The lead author of the report, Stone, and her colleagues wrote suicide rates might be stable or even decline during a disaster, only to rise again afterwards. As the nation continues to respond to the short and long-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, remaining vigilant in prevention efforts is critical, especially among disproportionately affected populations, where longer-term impacts might compound pre-existing inequities in suicide risk. CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to estimates published by the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, preliminary data suggests suicide rates in the United States had not significantly improved overall through the first quarter of 2022. However, rates varied widely in several states for 2022 compared to 2021. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has long tracked disparities in rates of suicide. In 2020, even as suicide rates declined amid the first year of the pandemic overall, the agency had found suicide increasing among Hispanic men and non-Hispanic multiracial women. The report's authors wrote, "Suicide is a complex problem related to multiple risk factors such as relationship, job, or school, and financial problems, as well as mental illness, substance abuse, social isolation, historical trauma, barriers to healthcare, and easy access to lethal means of suicide among persons at risk." Citing an analysis published in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, the authors also cautioned that suicide rates have been seen rising after other disasters, even after appearing to immediately plateau or fall. The authors of the report wrote, "As the nation continues to respond to the short and long-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, remaining vigilant in prevention efforts is critical, especially among disproportionately affected populations, where longer-term impacts might compound pre-existing inequities in the suicide risk." The report breaks down the data only by age and gender, but previous CDC data has shown that some groups are more vulnerable than others, including Native Americans, veterans, and those living in rural areas. Mental health has also deteriorated significantly among the youth during the pandemic, with more than 40% of teenagers saying they persistently felt sad or hopeless during the past year. Major pediatric health groups have declared a national state of emergency in children's mental health. The new national suicide hotline, 988, saw a 45% spike in calls in the first week after its introduction in July of 2022.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today, in our studio, we have with us our special guest, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and a research scholar over here in the Hafza Almi of Qom. And we have been discussing a series of, we went through a series of episodes with Professor Naqvi where we discussed the levels of tarbiyah and most important topics of tarbiyah Islamic upbringing with him. And today we are continuing some important topic with him. Professor, in our previous episodes, we discussed the issues of dignity in terms of freedom and justice. And now when dignity comes to the relation of parent and children, what do you comment on that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, thank you very much. We discussed the matter of freedom and justice. We said that basically in Islam, freedom and justice, equality, these are all important values which have to be taken care of. But the ultimate thing is the preservation of human dignity. Freedom within the framework of human dignity, justice within the framework of human dignity is important. For example, previously we would have the Western bloc, the liberal bloc, talking about freedom. We would have the communist bloc, the Eastern bloc, talking about human social justice. But both of them expressed and mentioned these things and implemented them in such a way, and they even still do, which in such a manner that infringes upon the dignity of mankind. So the important thing is that, yes, we accept freedom and we accept justice, social justice in all our relations. But to the extent that human dignity and honor is not trampled upon. So this was the main idea that we discussed previously in the previous episodes. Now today we want to take this to a practical result. How does this manifest itself in relations between human beings, especially parents and their children? So human dignity and honor and respect for each other have to be taken into mind and have to be considered when we are dealing with our children, or the children are dealing with their parents. It's both ways. It's not just that the children should be respecting their parents. The other way around is also true. Parents should also deal and behave and treat their children as human beings who have dignity and have honor.
So parents, it's not like you are a child, you know nothing, I have more experience, so you are ought to respect me, I'm not ought to respect you. It's a vice versa process. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we're discussing dignity in relation with parents and children. Professor Nakavi, you said dignity is something that both sides have to take care of. It's not just parents have to be expecting from their children, even the parents themselves have to show some respect.
What it means when I say that, yes, certainly children have to treat their parents with respect and honor to maintain their dignity. But how can this be achieved? The parents have to teach them to be respectful. They have to become examples. So when they treat their children in a way that they show their respect for their own children, and they talk to them not as if they were their subjects whom they were going to command as lords and kings and so on and so forth. We consider our children to be our own property, for example. And we think that however we behave with them, it doesn't make any difference. No, if we want them to respect us and we want them to honor us and maintain that dignity, they should be taught how to do that. And the best way to do it is to respect the parents should talk to their children in a way that their honor and their dignity and their ego is not hurt. Of course, the question is, how can that be managed? This is the issue. Why should it be managed and how it should be managed? Number one, we should, as I said, why? The why is very obvious. They're not our slaves, they're not our properties, they're trusts given to us by their amanats given to us by Allah Almighty.
And we'll be asked about them.
We will be asked about them. And we will be asked about them in this way, that how did you
bring them up?
How did you educate them? How did you try to educate them and to change their behavior? So the change of the behavior, or me as a parent, if I treat my children in a way that their honor and dignity is maintained and preserved and then bring them up, then that is the best way to do it, because they will learn to honor themselves, they will learn to respect themselves, and they will learn to respect others. If I trample upon them, if I subject them to harsh treatment, and all the time I'm scolding them, and all the time I'm telling them off, then they will also...
They'll automatically don't have any respect left for you.
They will not have any respect left for themselves. And that could lead to serious implications in their personality. They could become obsessive. They could become, to an extent, they start becoming self-inflicting upon themselves harm. They would consider themselves to be of no use. They would lose any sense of direction and sense of purpose in this life. So if we want to change their behavior, we have to change our behavior, as we have always been saying. So, and one of the things that we have to teach them is to be able to respect themselves and respect others. And we have to show how to do that.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the Holy Prophet standing up for Bibi Fatima to Zahra, salamu alayha, it's...
In her honor.
It's in her honor. It's telling us both things. It's telling us that the Lady Fatima is of a very important status in the eyes of the Holy Prophet.
Yeah.
And more than
meanwhile,
that...
Meanwhile, teaching a lot to the parents.
To parents, that this is how you should treat your...
Exactly. Daughters, especially. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
Ya Muqiyal Khayrat, يا مقي الخيرات يا مقي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقي الخيرات يا مقي الخيرات.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said there was a practical example that Prophet, peace be upon him, taught us while he would stand in the honor of his daughter. It in itself, this example taught a lot many things to a lot many people, and you were explaining that.
Yes. And we also find the example of great personalities, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, teaching an elderly guy, old person, how to perform ablution. They taught him in such a way that he did not feel offended. So here, the example we are taking, the lesson we are learning, is that we want to teach others to become good people. We want them to become good people and good servants of Allah Almighty. We want our children to become not our servants, but the servants of Allah Almighty.
Indeed.
So we need to teach them in such a way that they maintain and preserve their self-respect and their dignity and their honor, and they carry out whatever they are supposed to do with a sense of duty, with a sense of responsibility. Not because my father or mother is saying so, it's because it's the best thing that I should be doing.
Yeah.
And my parents want the best from me.
Exactly.
And they should also feel that what we are here to offer is not just because we want it, it's because what is the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Islam tells us to take care of. Islam is all about carrying out the best things in the best possible manner.
Yeah.
That is what we have been saying is ihsan. When we say wa bil walidayni ihsana, how should we behave with our parents? Bil ihsan, with the best
with the
possible
goodness,
good deeds. It's not a favor upon them. Ihsan is not doing a favor to someone,
yeah,
as it is normally considered.
Taken into
yes.
that way.
Ihsan
in
is doing
cultures.
Good things, good deeds in the excellent possible way. So it's and it follows from the ubudiyah of Allah Almighty. It's not separate from the ubudiyah, because before that, the holy verse is talking about servitude and obedience and the worship of Allah Almighty. And in its continuation, we're talking about the ihsan to our parents. So it's a continuity. It's a continuum. It's not something separate.
Yeah.
If we want to respect our parents, if we want to do good services, provide good services to them, be good to them, it is a continuation of the obedience to Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
It's not separable.
Separate from them.
So our children must not feel that what I'm asking them as a parent is because I want it. I desire it. It should be that he feels that whatever
what
my...
What is good for my child?
What is good and what Islam has presented to us. So therefore, we need to, not only when we're talking to our children, when treating them offering them our advice, we are telling them what to do, how to do it. First, offer them a practical example, and then talk to them in such a way that they do not feel offended. Of course, I don't say that no, we should not teach them, we should not offend them at all. No, sometimes it becomes necessary to hurt one's feelings to make him stop and refrain from doing something bad. So that is also a form of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, but it has its own place.
So letting the child always feel on the cloud nine is also not good.
No, so there should be a balance.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and sharing such beautiful thoughts with our audience. Thank you, the audience, for being with us. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab, COI, Call of Islam, and out there you can find our old programs. Well, if you wish to write us something, your questions, your feedback, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And in case you want to listen to us on social media, you can search Call of Islam. We are on all social media platforms. Thank you for listening. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The U.S. experienced more than 600 mass shootings in 2022, nearly double the number recorded 4 years ago when there were 336. This was reported by the Washington-based Gun Violence Archive. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, Americans not only kill other people by the millions, at least 32 million have been killed since 2001. They also kill their own by the tens of thousands. In 2022, the nonprofit group Gun Violence Archive recorded 43,789 deaths in 2022 related to gun violence in the U.S. Even children are not spared, as the latest figures released by Gun Violence Archive, GVA, on December 27, 2022 showed. At least 6,032 children, 17 years or younger, have been killed or injured in 2022 so far, according to GVA data. The GVA figures for 2022 showed that 306 children, 11 years of age and younger, died by gunfire. Another 668 were injured. The figure for age bracket 12 to 17 provide an even more horrifying picture. 1,325 deaths and 3,732 injuries due to gunfire. This is the highest number of gun-related casualties since the GVA started keeping a record in 2014. The 2022 figures mark a notable increase in number of deaths and injuries since last year, when 5,708 casualties were recorded across the U.S. So far, there have been 609 mass shootings in the U.S. up to November 2022, according to GVA figures. Will these figures reach more than that number by the end of the year 2023 to equal the highest number of shootings recorded in the U.S.? Schools across the U.S. have also been targeted. On May 24, 2022, one of the most horrific school mass shootings occurred at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Salvador Ramos, 18, entered the school and barricaded himself in a classroom where he shot and killed 19 students aged 7 to 10 and two teachers. Before arriving at the school for his shooting spree, Ramos had also shot his grandmother. She was admitted to hospital in critical condition where she died. Ramos was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents and UCISD officers after they breached the classroom. Families of the victims of Uvalde school shooting have since launched a class action lawsuit against local and state police, the city, and other school and law enforcement officials seeking $27 billion due to delays in confronting the attacker, court documents show. The lawsuit filed in Austin, Texas, states that law enforcement officials failed to follow active attacker protocol when they waited for 77 minutes before confronting the attacker inside a fourth grade classroom. While the most recent school mass shooting, Uvalde, was not the most horrific, it was preceded by such other school shootings at those as Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut on December 14, 2012, and the Virginia Tech shooting in Blacksburg, Virginia of April 16, 2007. At a Sandy Hook Elementary School, 20-year-old Adam Lanza arrived with four guns. He entered a first-grade class where he shot and killed 20 children aged 6 and 7, along with six adults, including four teachers, the principal, and the school psychologist. Two other people were injured. He also shot himself before the police arrived. In the Virginia Tech shooting, 23-year-old student Song Hoi Cho killed 32 students and faculty members in two separate attacks on campus. He also injured 17 others before committing suicide. On April 20th, 1999, a school shooting and attempting bombing occurred at Columbine High School in Columbine, Colorado, that came to set an example for mass shootings at schools across the U.S. The perpetrators were two 12th grade students, Eric David Harris and Dylan Bennett Klebold. They murdered 12 students and one teacher before they committed suicide. It was the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history at the time. Texas, Florida, and California have also recorded multiple school shootings. China Daily also reported in 2022 the U.S. again led the world in gun-related deaths, more than 20,900, including homicides and suicide, Gun Violence Archive says. And the U.S. has the highest number of guns per capita at more than 400 million weapons, meaning there is more than one gun for every man, woman, and child. Richard Burke, a professor emeritus of criminology and statistics at the University of Pennsylvania, told the Washington Post, "Many other countries have disadvantaged folks who are angry and alienated. But guns aren't there. Mass shootings in the U.S. have followed a predictable and superficial script, with a few exceptions. They produce calls for greater gun controls, including banning automatic weapons. Gun advocates defend the right to bear arms. There are instant monuments to victims, and there are candlelight vigils. The media profiles the victims and the shooter. The shooter's Facebook page or blog will be found, and perhaps a note giving a hint of why the shooting happens. And there are heartfelt comments from politicians from the local level to the White House. China Daily added, with few exceptions, most of the shootings fade from the national conversation, but the scenario unfolds again when the new one occurs. There are those who offer a radical solution: arm good guys to take on bad guys, and that is what is happening in the U.S. The increase in the number of public shootings involving guns is causing people to arm themselves out of fear. Gun sales peak after mass shootings, partly for fear of victimization and partly for fear of increased regulation. They rose after school shootings amid coronavirus shutdowns, racial justice protests, the presidential election in 2020, and after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. There is deadly gun violence in the U.S. every day, and mass shootings, especially in schools, draw much more attention. However, those shootings represent a fraction of gun violence overall, said Gillian Peterson, an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hemline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and co-founder of the Violence Project, which studies mass killers. Mass shootings, Peterson told the Post, account for fewer than 1% of all people killed by firearms. They are very rare still, even though they are increasing. Mass shootings by design are meant to go viral, Peterson said. The goal of them is fame, notoriety. Public mass shootings have a psychological impact on people, instilling fear of going to movies or a grocery store, she said. While mass shootings draw attention, most gun deaths in the U.S. are either suicides or homicides, according to federal figures, with accidental or unterminated gun deaths representing a small fraction of the overall share. Almost 60% of gun deaths each year are suicides, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention says.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.